you know, before we went into the news, I was saying, you know, how the big winner that got the big takeaway, I suppose, of the budget is, as pretty much expected, as he has been alluding to on his Twitter feed, as I think most of us could have probably assumed, the biggest winners of the budget happened to be the SOEs, the Land Bank, getting the 3 billion rand allocation, having gotten the 3 billion rand allocation in June, is actually going to be getting another 7 billion rand, SAA getting the 10.5 billion rand on top of the 16.5 billion rand that it's gotten in past. But I'd like to just play the clip that we had wanted you to hear of Ditumbuweni giving us that outline of where the SOEs will be benefiting.
3 billion rand was allocated to the Land Bank in June. The bank will require an additional 7 billion rand over the medium term to support its restructuring and refocus. R10.5 billion is allocated to SAA to implement its business rescue plan. Well, let me repeat. R10.5 billion is allocated to SAA to implement its business rescue plan. This allocation is funded through reductions to the baselines of national departments, public entities, and conditional grants. This allocation is in addition to the 16.4 billion rand allocated over the 2020 MTF in the February budget for settling guaranteed debt and interest. You can't run away from your obligations. You can't run away from your obligations.
That's Minister Ditumbuweni there giving us some basic lessons in obligations. Obligations which at the beginning of the year and at the end of last year we were told were not necessarily going to be the responsibility of the state. I remember distinctly DPE Minister Pravin Gordhan saying SAA is not too big to fail. And now it's our obligation that we can't run away from. Well, let me give it to somebody else who might be a little less sick of this than I. Kaya Sithole, author and economic analyst, joining us to give his review of the budget. Welcome back to the show, Kaya. How are you doing?
I'm good, and good morning to the listeners.
All righty. What's your first take? What, in a word, how would you describe that budget?
It was disastrous, but that
Thank
was
you.
To be expected. Yes. And I think the reality here is that we don't have much left in the kitty. And, of course, when there's not much left to play with, it means that you're busily shuffling, taking from one cabinet and putting into the next without giving us a cogent plan of how you're actually going to raise public finances. And I think what we're seeing here is that it's a minister who's run out of ideas. It's a government that's run out of ideas. It's a government that doesn't even have the time to address what, for me, is still the most pressing challenge of our time, which is the question of should the vaccine for the pandemic be found tomorrow, how exactly are we going to finance our participation in it? Because a lot of the issues that we are now trying to deal with are linked to the question of whether we can solve the healthcare crisis. If we cannot resolve the healthcare crisis, we cannot unlock full economic activity. And if we cannot do that, most of the things that the minister was talking about yesterday can never materialize anyway.
A chilling thought. So we may well find ourselves in this purgatory of lockdown at various low levels, let's say, for example, where we sit at the moment for an extended period, which doesn't actually allow us to reach any sincere return to economic activity that we were accustomed to. Now, you mentioned that one of the issues, and I agree with you, that didn't really come up was the ability to actually raise public finances. But there seemed to be foreboding around pretty bad news for us taxpayers in February.
Well, of course, I think it is inevitable that when governments run out of money, the first respect that they always seek to go to is back to the taxpayer, because the one thing that is unique about taxpayers is that they cannot say no. All you do is you simply pass a law that says that on your basis as a citizen, I've decided to take 40%, 50% or 60% of your income and redistribute it in the form of tax. And unless you are able to escape that country, you're stuck with it. So it's always going to come back to the taxpayer, which is why the taxpayers must take full responsibility for the government that they choose. And I think the tension point here in South Africa is that people do not acknowledge the fact that you only ever get the government of your choice. And of course, if we feel that the government of our choice is not acting in our best interest, well, we've got the right to vote them out in the ballot box. But of course, if you keep endorsing the same party for five elections in a row, it's difficult for them to see anything wrong that they're doing.
Absolutely. And it's not as if they haven't given you examples in those five elections of why you should probably make a different choice. So here we are. We've chosen this particular government. We've gotten to a point, I'm sure we're very deep on the opposite side of the Laffer curve. It is now, we are at a level of taxation that is prohibitive, right? And any kind of increase in taxation, we've already heard people speaking quite loudly, opposition parties and others, about resisting paying tax. But if not... resisting paying tax, you're going to start finding a greater deal of tax avoidance, aren't we?
Yeah, the problem is that our government has got a very limited understanding of the Laffer curve to begin with. We're definitely on the wrong side of it now. But also, quite importantly, the question of how high taxes can go is not a question of numbers. It's a question of efficiencies. If it turns out that I pay 50% of my taxes towards the state, but the state guarantees my safety, my security, and quality education, it would mean that I do not have to fund all those other activities from my after-tax income. I don't have to pay for private schools. I don't have to pay for private security. The fact that I'm paying for those means that there's an additional tax burden that I cannot avoid because I want to be safe. So in South Africa, in fact, the tax burden is much higher than what the quoted tax rate is. And I think that's the problem that the government doesn't seem to acknowledge, in that nobody is going to begrudge you for raising taxes if they can see where those taxes are going, where they can see the direct benefit and the direct improvements in their lives. We just don't see the correlation in South Africa between our taxes going up and us feeling that we are living in a much safer environment where the quality of life is improving every day. And that is why people then engage in incidences of tax avoidance, because they're simply saying, well, I'm much better off spending this money my way in a way that makes me safe. I can direct where it goes rather than hearing the next story tomorrow about how it got looted when I gave it to the state.
And that failure of delivery sits, squarely with those civil servants who are, quite upset about the third year of the wage agreement being in the air at the moment. What do you think is going to happen going forward?
Well, the problem with that wage agreement is that it is what you may call a treasonous arrangement. Whoever signed that wage agreement into law 3 years ago did not acknowledge the fact that the state finances could never sustain the type of wage agreement that was signed back then. The problem, of course, is that we know that such wage agreements are always inked together ahead of a general election, because the ANC cannot countenance the idea of a general
strike. But what are the union's next steps?
Yeah. So now the unions are obviously now going to have to explain to their members why these increases are not only not coming for the current year where they've been budgeted for, but also the fact that the state is now saying that for the next 2 years we are cutting the public service wage bill, and I think it's going to create a lot of tensions.
For settling guaranteed debt and interest. You can't run away from your obligations.
That's Minister Tito Mboweni there, giving us some basic lessons in obligations. Obligations which at the beginning of the year and at the end of last year, we were told, were not necessarily going to be the responsibility of the state. I remember distinctly DPE Minister Pravin Gordhan saying SAA is not too big to fail. And now it's our obligation that we can't run away from. Well, let me give it to somebody else who might be a little less sick of this than I. Kaya Sithole, author and economic analyst, joining us to give his review of the budget. Welcome back to the show, Kaya. How are you doing?
I'm good, and good morning to the listeners.
All righty. What's your first take? What, in a word, how would you describe that budget?
It was disastrous, but that was to be expected. Yes. And I think the reality here is that we don't have much left in the kitty. And of course, when there's not much left to play with, it means that you're busily shuffling, taking from one cabinet and putting into the next without giving us a cogent plan of how you're actually going to raise public finances. And I think what we're seeing here is that it's a minister who's run out of ideas. It's a government that's run out of ideas. It's a government that doesn't even have the time to address what for me is still the most pressing challenge of our time, which is the question of, should the vaccine for the pandemic be found tomorrow, how exactly are we going to finance our participation in it? Because a lot of the issues that we are now trying to deal with are linked to the question of whether we can solve the healthcare crisis. If we cannot resolve the healthcare crisis, we cannot unlock full economic activity. And if we cannot do that, most of the things that the minister was talking about yesterday can never materialize anyway.
a chilling thought. So we find ourselves, we may well find ourselves in this purgatory of lockdown at various low levels, let's say, for example, where we sit at the moment for an extended period, which doesn't actually allow us to reach any sincere return, excuse me, to economic activity that we were accustomed to. Now, yeah, you mentioned that one of the issues, and I agree with you, that didn't really come up was the ability to actually raise public finances. But there seemed to be foreboding around pretty bad news for us taxpayers in February.
Well, of course, I think it is inevitable that when governments run out of money, the first respect that they always seek to go to is back to the taxpayer, because the one thing that is unique about taxpayers is that they cannot say no. All you do is you simply pass a law that says that on your basis as a citizen, I've decided to take 40%, 50% or 60% of your income and redistribute it in the form of tax. And unless you are able to escape that country, you're stuck with it. So it's always going to come back to the taxpayer, which is why the taxpayers must take full responsibility for the government that they choose. And I think the tension point here in South Africa is that people do not acknowledge the fact that you only ever get the government of your choice. And of course, if you feel that the government of our choice is not acting in our best interest, well, we've got the right to vote them out in the ballot box. But of course, if you keep endorsing the same party for five elections in a row, stick up for them to see anything wrong that they're doing.
Absolutely. And it's not as if they haven't given you examples in those five elections of why you should probably make a different choice. So here we are. We've chosen this particular government. We've gotten to a point, I'm sure we're very deep on the opposite side of the Laffer curve. It is now, we are at a level of taxation that is prohibitive, right? And any kind of increase in taxation, we've already heard people speaking quite loudly, opposition parties and others, about resisting paying tax. But if not, you know, resisting paying tax, you're going to start finding a greater deal of tax avoidance, aren't we?
Yeah, the problem is that our government has got a very limited understanding of the Laffer curve to begin with. We're definitely on the wrong side of it now. But also, quite importantly, the question of how high taxes can go is not a question of numbers. It's a question of efficiencies. If it turns out that I pay 50% of my taxes towards the state, but the state guarantees my safety, my security, and quality education, it would mean that I do not have to fund all those other activities from after-tax income. I don't have to pay for private schools. I don't have to pay for private security. The fact that I'm paying for those means that they're an additional tax burden that I cannot avoid because I want to be safe. So in South Africa, in fact, the tax burden is much higher than what the quoted tax rate is. And I think that's the problem that the government doesn't seem to acknowledge, in that nobody is going to begrudge you for raising taxes if they can see where those taxes are going, where they can see the direct benefit and the direct improvements in their lives. We just don't see the correlation in South Africa between our taxes going up and us feeling that we are living in a much safer environment where the quality of life is improving every day. And that is why people then engage in incidences of tax avoidance, because they're simply saying, well, I'm much better off spending this money my way in a way that makes me safe. I can direct where it goes rather than hearing the next story tomorrow about how it got looted when I gave it to the state.
And that failure of delivery sits, you know, squarely with those civil servants who are, you know, quite upset about the third year of the wage agreement being in the air at the moment. What do you think is going to happen going forward?
Well, the problem with that wage agreement is that it is what you may call a treasonous arrangement. Whoever signed that wage agreement into law 3 years ago did not acknowledge the fact that the state finances could never sustain the type of wage agreement that was signed back then. The problem, of course, is that we know that such wage agreements are always inked together ahead of a general election, because the ANC cannot countenance the idea of a general strike.
But what are the unions' next steps?
Yeah. So now the unions are obviously now going to have to explain to their members why these increases are not only not coming for the current year where they've been budgeted for, but also the fact that the state is now saying that for the next 2 years, we are cutting the public service wage bill. And I think it's going to create a lot of tensions between the ANC and the unions. But it's a necessary tension, because in the absence of that tension being resolved, it will simply mean that they come back to the taxpayer and say, look, we're struggling to placate the unions, so give us more money so we can pay the civil services, the civil servants, the money that they want. But clearly, that's an unsustainable trend. It was always going to happen that this conflict between the ANC and the union would materialize, and now is the time.
Taking us right back squarely to what you mentioned earlier about the vote. Kaisi Tole, thank you so much, author and economic analyst, for that perspective.